This is True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup.
I feel and believe that aesthetic medicine is not only a science, it's also an art. Anyone can hold a syringe of Botox. It depends on how it's placed, where it's placed, the amount that's placed, and things like that.
In this series of podcasts, I talk to people at the forefront of the creative industries about their work and their relationship to luxury. My guest this week is Dr. Marwa Ali, one of the world's leading aesthetic doctors whose clinic is here at Harrods. Admirers of her skill and her less is more approach mean that she has clients all over the world and has become something of a celebrity herself. Marwa, you usually practice in the wellness clinic several floors below us here in Harrods. When did you know that you wanted to be a doctor? You attended St. George's as a student, but at what point did you know that that was the career that you were after?
It's very strange, but I always knew I wanted to be a doctor. It was something that I always aspired to be. However, I didn't know what type of doctor I wanted to be, and I grew up thinking I wanted to do something in cardiology, maybe possibly be a heart surgeon, because I know I'm very creative. And whilst in medical school, actually, I thought possibly I'd like to be a plastic surgeon because that has elements of creativity. You utilize your manual dexterity and so on and so forth. However, in the fourth year of medical school, I discovered dermatology. And it combined everything from, you know, using your vision to visualize skin disease, as well as minor operations to, you know, remove,
unwanted bits.
Exactly. and therefore, I thought that, you know, this is the path I wanted to go down. And slowly, I discovered aesthetic medicine, and it just had the perfect combination of beauty, medical knowledge, medical skill, manual dexterity, and everything that I'm very passionate about. Actually, it's really funny. Whilst I was in medical school, I was questioning whether I wanted to pursue my career in medicine altogether. I attended lots of, worldwide fashion shows in New York Fashion Week and in Paris Couture Fashion Week. And I told my father I'd actually like to be a fashion designer. And I started drawing all these dresses, and I said, this is it, this is what I'm going to do. And he said, listen, just finish medical school and then we can decide that later. As soon as I completed medical school, he said, just finish your training and then we can decide later. And
clever
one
man.
Step led to another, and I discovered my true passion, which was aesthetic medicine.
Though I have to say, you can still be spotted looking at the runways of, you know, any number of designer shows around the world still. So fashion is still obviously
Fashion is definitely a very big passion of mine, and I've always been very fond of wearing things which are quite quirky and different growing up. Yeah, so I've definitely enjoyed fashion very much.
Was that something that that you were encouraged in? I mean, you grew up in London, didn't
yes,
you?
Yeah.
But your parents, do they grow up in London?
My mother
too?
Grew up in London. My father grew up in Iraq and came here about 40 years ago. It's really interesting because I have the cultural aspect of the Middle East as well as, you know, growing up here in the West. And I think the fusion of both means that I can enjoy fashion to my heart's content as well as be quite traditional.
We've described you as an aesthetic doctor.
Yeah.
But I suppose a lot of people would kind of think, oh, I wonder what that means, and associate it with cosmetic surgery. Do you think that plastic surgery has sort of developed such a bad name that people now don't want to be associated with it? I mean, is that part of the reason for sort of reinventing the wheel when it comes to that business?
I think it's really interesting. People often have this great misconception that doing anything aesthetic means that you're going to look incredibly fake. Traditionally, we see people in Hollywood who look quite distorted and unnatural. And now there's a new wave and a new approach to aesthetic medicine where we try to achieve results that look so subtle and so natural that no one can actually detect it at all. And it's quite beautiful when most patients leave my clinic and come back after their 2-week review and say that everyone just said that I looked really fresh, or my skin looked really good, and that I was glowing and I looked well rested. And that's really the main objective. The objective is not to change the way you look. It's just to enhance certain features and turn back the clock and maintain a very young, youthful appearance. So it's all about facial rejuvenation. Of course, there are some procedures like a non-surgical rhinoplasty that do warrant a change in appearance. It all depends on the treatment objective and what the patient is looking for and trying to achieve. But generally, I try to re-educate patients and I try to explain that in order to achieve a very subtle and natural approach by doing very small amounts regularly and in the right place and at the right time, and a combination approach is always advised. So, I mean, we've changed the way that we practice aesthetic medicine completely, the way that we use fillers, the way that we use Botox. It's all about baby Botox, less is more. Again, with fillers, we place it in places where we're trying to replace fat pads that, you know, decrease in volume over time, rather than try to recreate something that wasn't there altogether.
Did you always know that you were going to go to the beauty end of aesthetic work, or were you at any point going to pursue surgery on the more general scale, you know, burn victims and...
I actually wanted to become a plastic surgeon after seeing, actually attending one of my friend's father's premieres for this film called Saving Face. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I have heard
of
it.
He's a plastic surgeon who used to practice in Chelsea and Westminster. And he traveled the world where there were lots of burns victims, and he helped give them basically a new face, you know, using, you know, skin grafts and things like that. And that really inspired me. And I thought, you know, this is the most beautiful gift that you can give to anyone. But what's interesting is that I found in aesthetic medicine, you can also give people confidence. I mean, I see patients who have grossly mismatched or asymmetrical faces, which is genetic. Or I see people who have been involved in car accidents and have had surgery, but just need that extra rebalancing of the face, you know, and don't want to undergo surgery. So it's so rewarding to be able to give that gift to someone and to be able to give someone that confidence. And even just someone who's just feeling just, you know, exhausted and run down and like that their faces, you know, just look worn out and tired, to be able to give them that confidence and just turn back the clock for them is just quite magical.
We'll talk about turning back the clock in a minute, but I thought it would be quite interesting to just hear a little bit more about what you actually do or what you can actually do. So let's pretend, if you might, that I've come to see you for some help.
Okay.
with my 56-year-old face. How would you talk to me? What would you say to me? What would you offer me?
So I think in general, when I do see anyone, it's obviously we assess everyone as an individual because no face is ever the same, and everyone.
I don't hurt easily, by the way.
So okay.
I mean, what I mean is, I do. I hate pain.
Yeah.
So that would probably make me a very bad patient. But you won't be insulting me in anything you say. So feel free to go for it for the full package.
Okay. So I like to go very slow. And I like to, first of all, start off with lifestyle factors and skincare, because I think that obviously and would make the biggest difference to someone's face, okay? I also believe in prevention, which is better than cure. So using things like SPF and good skincare is paramount. Moving on from that, I would approach things like, you know, wrinkles. So going slow is very important to me. So we'd start off with baby Botox. If someone is not comfortable with that, we do a couple of areas first, ask them to come back and just build their confidence in having Botox so that they see how natural it can appear.
Botox obviously got a very bad name because...
Yeah.
We're walking around with sort of what looked
with
like
shiny faces, foreheads, which were immobile.
Wrinkled, no character.
Exactly. And now we use baby Botox, which allows you to have movement, but just softens lines or prevents them from developing altogether. And we can also use Botox to lift the eyebrow, for example, which tends to drop with age, and just lift the neck muscles and without having to use any...
You're talking about my neck and my eyebrows, aren't you? I can see she's actually looking straight at me and she's
I'm just saying in
eyebrows
general.
That tend to drop with age, neck muscles that need to go up. So is that where you'd start?
Like I think baby Botox is a good way to start without someone feeling like, oh my gosh, there's been such a drastic change. So you still have the movement, but you just look fresher and just look well-rested. I think that's a really good way to start.
Okay, and then what can you do? Because, let's just talk about my face. I've got these long lines that run from my nose down the side of my mouth.
They're called the nasolabial fold.
Nasolabial fold.
Yeah, so previously, if someone like you would come to us and say, you know, this is my presenting complaint and I don't like this nasolabial fold, the doctor would use a filler to fill out that line. Now, what we try to do, instead of filling out lines, we try to replace volume lost, and we try to treat the cause rather than the effect of volume loss. So that line is caused by loss of volume in the midface, which is the first area that we lose in our face.
Dropping down.
Exactly. Followed by...
Just saying the harsh bits, because Marwa clearly is trying to be gentle with me.
No. So we'd re-volumize the midface and also treat skin laxity and try to strengthen the foundations of the face.
So get my cheekbones to go up.
Yes, but obviously...
And that would then pull up the nasolabial fold. Yeah. I'm getting good at this now.
Yeah.
Okay.
So also, there's something called HIFU, which is high-intensity focused ultrasound, which basically uses ultrasound in a different modality in aesthetic medicine. So ultrasound is used in medicine to do a variety of things. It can be used to visualize your internal organs. It can also be used to break down tumors beneath the skin surface without actually making a cut or incision into the skin. And in aesthetic medicine, we can use different levels of, or strengths rather, of ultrasound at varying depths beneath the skin surface to target different structures. So for example, around the neck and jawline area, we can use it to target the muscle fibers, which become very loose and long with age, to tighten them.
So you could make my jawline go straight
tighter.
Again.
We can also use it to break down subcutaneous fat that starts to develop with age. So like the double chin, for example. You can also use it around, I'm not saying that you have it, I'm saying in general. And we can also use it over the whole face to target, so to stimulate collagen production and tighten and lift the skin. And as we age, from the age of 20 onwards, the levels of collagen are declining in our skin. And that leads to, you know, poor texture and quality of the skin. It leads to development of fine lines and increased skin laxity. So what we try to do is reverse that, without having to add anything to the face.
And the thing is, though, that the technologies are changing all the time, aren't they? I mean, the things you're describing now, I'm sure if I'd talked to someone who did the same job as you 20 years ago,
yes,
half those things at least wouldn't have been available or
exactly,
wouldn't have been understood. So it's a difficult business, isn't it? Because you sort of see people with a 1980s facelift.
Yep.
And that looks completely incongruous in the 21st century.
You know what? I actually think that the advancements and progression in aesthetic medicine will mean that young girls will never have to undergo a facelift in the future. We can definitely prevent it through all of the techniques and procedures that we do have available to continuously maintain the levels of collagen and maintain a very natural looking appearance through injectables and things like ultrasound.
But how do you feel about that? About the idea that, you know, I mean, the pursuit of youth is, you know, it's a losing battle, isn't it? Ultimately, we're all going to die.
I think we all have to accept that with age, we are going to change and we have to embrace it and enjoy it because, you know, I mean, there's nothing wrong with having a few wrinkles, you know, this is life, you know, and we have to embrace it. I mean, sometimes people come to me and they're so hung up on having a nasolabial fold. And I say to them, listen, I have a 9-year-old child and he has a nasolabial fold. It's a normal feature. So it's about re-educating people to embrace the process. But, you know, there's no harm in having a little help along the way.
How do you deal with people who get, because, you know, there's a lot of talk about people who become sort of addicted to it and, you know, you do a little bit and then you want a little bit more and a little bit more and the next thing you look like the lady, I can't remember what she was called, Jocelyn Wildebeest or whatever.
So the cat lady.
Cat lady. You know, and you're still looking in the mirror thinking, oh, I look great.
Yeah, I think the key is to find a doctor who is ethical and knows the limitations and is always... who will say no to you when they think it's going too far. And someone who obviously has a good eye and is very skilled at what they do, and possibly someone who doesn't look like a train wreck themselves. Because I have to say, when I do go to some of these cosmetic conferences, I don't know what happens to some doctors, but I think they lose sight of what is natural and what is unnatural. And honestly, sometimes I had to actually leave a lecture once because the lady standing in front of me looked so horrific that I thought, how could I take you seriously and how can I listen to this lecture of you teaching me how to improve someone's appearance when you don't look good at all? Essentially, you have to practice what you preach. And if you have to go to someone who you've seen obviously their work. But having said that, I don't trust Instagram so much or the internet, because obviously there are apps where you can edit faces.
You should see me as a man. It's quite interesting.
There are people who steal other people's pictures, unfortunately. You do your research. Ask people.
If I asked you what age you were, it would be under no obligation at all to tell me. Is the point that I can't really tell?
Yes. Often I travel with my son and people think he's my brother. They ask me, what's your secret? And I say, Botox. And they say, oh, no, I don't think I could possibly do that. I was like, well, I don't look fake in my opinion. I can still move my face and no one could ever tell. I mean, I've grown up with people and they're shocked when I tell them I've had some filler and some Botox.
And what age did you first start using the things that you were using?
So I'm going to be very honest, and 21. I was 21 when I needed, no one ever needs it, but when I decided to delve into the aesthetic world and have some Botox. I'm a frowner, and whilst I was in medical school, everyone always thought I was angry, even though I was just trying to juggle marriage, motherhood. Well, I wasn't a mother then, but, you know.
Thinking about motherhood can be exhausting as well.
Yeah.
You seem to lead a similar lifestyle to that of your clients. You know, you're forever flying off, jetting off around the world. You're often at couture shows and so on. Do you think that that helps in a way for people to feel very comfortable with you? I mean, people fly you halfway across the world just to get you to do their baby Botox, don't they?
I think it's important. I mean, I'm living the life that I enjoy, and I'm being true to myself. Like, I enjoy fashion, I enjoy traveling. It's interesting because I think that it's important to be relatable to everyone.
Is it hard being involved in a business that most of the time people don't want anyone to know they're involved in? So in most businesses you can go, oh yeah, I've got Coca-Cola as a client, or mm-hmm. But you probably spend most of your time going, no, I haven't seen anyone today really, and I don't remember their names if I did.
I think confidentiality is so important with any medical procedure, and you know, I've met some of the most remarkable people in the world through my work, and no one will ever hear it from me. Once I had a friend who's quite well known, and he came to see me, and he had referred another friend to come and see me who flew from across the world, and they were both in the clinic at the same time. I sent one person to one room and the other one to the other room, and I treated both of them. So one of the patients needed local anesthetic, so he had time to wait for me. And then they both left and found out that they were at the clinic at the same time and were like, how did I miss that? And I said, well, I had to explain that I have to respect everyone's privacy, and I can't share that information when I see someone. So, and they really respected that, and they felt really reassured. And I think it's super important that no matter how close you are to someone, no matter who you know, and whether they are, you know, known to someone else, that to keep everything very separate and very private.
Do you think you have to be a bit of a therapist as well as an aesthetic doctor? Because I've said to you, I'm resilient. You can say whatever you like about my face, but for a lot of people, it's a very sensitive issue, isn't it? And so on the one hand, you're trying to boost their confidence, but on the other, you're saying, well, you know, you probably could do with a little bit of cheeks lifted, you know, whatever the thing.
Yeah, I mean, I may have been slightly uncomfortable saying those things to you before, because I always allow the patient to tell me what they are very insecure about or what they want to treat, rather than myself suggesting things, because something that I may see may not be something that they see. And I don't think it's good to give people a complex about something that they never, ever noticed before. So I think it's important.
So not many people come in and go, what can you do for me?
Some people do. And I always say, tell me what you see. And they say, but I want you to tell me. And I said, I would really appreciate if we work together and for you to tell me what you see. So then if, for example, they say they hate their nasolabial fold, I will re-educate them about how to approach that and take it from there, rather than me saying, you need to do this, this and this, and this will make you look better. I don't agree with that.
What's the most difficult situation you've ever found yourself in?
So I have had patients who, people who have body dysmorphia people who don't see what you see. So who have, for example, very large lips, over-injected cheeks, and they come to you and say they want more. And it's not something that I feel comfortable doing. So I have to tell them that I'm really sorry, but I don't think I can deliver what you're expecting. Yeah, the most difficult thing is having to say no. But it's also the most ethical, and it's the right thing to do.
You know, in a funny way, what used to be called plastic surgery was regarded very much as a luxury. I mean, it was a very small minority of people who would embark on that course unless they'd had serious damage, you know, in an accident mm-hmm. or something. But nowadays, it doesn't feel so much like a luxury. It feels like it's become much more commonplace. Do you think that's the case?
Plastic surgery or aesthetic?
Cosmetic surgery. What we used to call cosmetic surgery, which actually used to cover even things like Botox and stuff, I know erroneously. Yeah. But, you know, what you do now,
yeah.
plus the operations and mm-hmm. the things that people used to do,
yeah.
you know, it used to be considered a sort of luxury thing to do. There seems to be a sense now that
more available to everyone.
Yeah, that it's become much more mainstream.
Yeah. It's always going to be a luxury, in my opinion, to be able to, you know, have any cosmetic procedure, whether it's surgical or non-surgical, because these things are not essential to life. You know, it's a luxury to be able to have those procedures and to be able to spend money to make yourself look better and feel better. However, I do understand what you mean by it being more available to the wider public.
There are lots more practitioners.
So there are lots more practitioners who are probably less experienced. And in that sense, I think it's not very luxurious to go and be treated by someone who's got very little experience or is not very popular because their skills aren't really that advanced. But I think it will always be a luxury if you're going to see someone who is, you know, very difficult to get an appointment with or is very skilled in what they do and able to deliver something that you want to achieve.
Is that where your creativity comes into it? Because I suppose there are people who know how to inject Botox into places where your face is crinkling, but a sense of a sort of vision, a broader vision
yeah.
of what you're trying to achieve.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. It's like, you know, because there are so many doctors and practitioners available right now to everyone at very ridiculously low prices, it's honestly like getting, you know, a Picasso and something that's not really well sought for, sought after.
The Bayswater Road,
exactly, maybe. You know, or getting a Chanel or something from Primark. You know, you do get what you pay for.
How does your job let you explore the creativity that you've cherished since you were a child?
I feel and believe that aesthetic medicine is not only a science, it's also an art. In order to be a good doctor, you have to obviously have the foundations, which are the medical knowledge and knowledge of anatomy of the face and the body. But essentially what you know distinguishes a very good doctor from a very average doctor is someone who's got a good eye, and is able to see things that other people can't. I mean, anyone can hold a syringe of Botox, but it depends on how it's placed, where it's placed, the amount that's placed, and things like that.
If people who are listening don't want to go down the route of aesthetic enhancement, but want to have better skin and, you know, get that glow and
yeah.
do those things, as an aesthetic doctor, what would be your recommendation in terms of, you know, healthier skin, healthier?
I would recommend coming in to see me for a consultation.
That's impossible for mere mortals with your packed back-to-back
diary.
We'll
make time for anyone and everyone. I think it's important to have a consultation and to use medical-grade skincare because we have a huge range of skincare available to the wider public, which they can be good. I consider them to be pamper products. But if you really want to prevent aging and maintain collagen levels and stimulate collagen production, I think it's essential to have medical grade products, which are prescription only. And those are the things that contain active ingredients at levels which are high enough to actually make a change. I mean, prevention for me is better than cure. So I think skincare is definitely the number one thing to do for everyone.
So what's your luxury in life?
My luxury
what's
in life?
The thing you consider, because I'm going to ask you in a moment about the luxury item you've brought in to show me.
Honestly, I was thinking about this a lot. And I think for me, what I consider luxury is being able to practice my dream job in the most beautiful and most luxurious setting and location in the world. I actually remember as a young girl, being 16, asking my father if I could have a job in Harrods and him saying no and saying, but I really want to work here. Like, you know, and he said, no, I'm sorry, it's not for you. And then after many years saying, oh, guess what, Dad, I have a job as a doctor in Harrods. And he was so proud of me, you know. I guess everything happens at the right time. And if you want something enough and you work hard enough, you're able to achieve it. So for me, my biggest luxury is obviously my job and having the most incredible people around me who support me and being able to spend quality time with my son as often as I do. For me, that's everything.
And obviously you spend a lot of time in Harrods just coming to the clinic and leaving.
Yeah.
And so where are your favourite places in the building, aside from your own workplace?
For me, the best places to visit in Harrods is the fine jewellery section. Yeah. It's always nice to look at sparkly things.
Thank you very, very much, Mawa Ali, Dr.
Thank
Mawa
Ali.
Thank
you so much for having me.
You've been listening to True Tales of Luxury with me, Mariella Frostrup, and my guest, Dr. Mawa Ali. Next week, I meet the pioneering podiatrician, Margaret Dabbs, who explains her love of feet and the ways we can all improve our own. This series is recorded in Harrods in London.